I think it's an upside-down world when we think that the ruling class in Washington, D.C. should be making all these calls and decisions for us.
A profile of U.S. Senate candidate Joe Miller. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, July 28th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a film highlights the deterioration of downtown Juneau.
It's not cherry-picked. It's not all the greatest hits from the last month. It's everything that just happened within a few days, and it's pretty pervasive.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Craig Taylor Equipment Company, an authorized John Deere dealer. The Anchorage location just behind the Ship Creek Salmon Fishing offers a wide range of John Deere compact tractors. CraigTaylorEquipment.com.
And by
BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
Most polls in the U.S. Senate race show Dan Sullivan ahead of rival Republican Mead Treadwell in the primary, but the Treadwell campaign is trumpeting a new analysis by the polling firm YouGov. It shows Treadwell would do better against incumbent Democratic Senator Mark Begich in November than Sullivan would. In a two-way contest, YouGov estimates Begich would lead Treadwell by 2 points, 47% to 45%. It says the gap between Begich and Sullivan is 12 points, 49% to 37%. The YouGov battleground tracker is sponsored by CBS and the New York Times. Nationwide, it shows Republicans have a slight advantage to take the majority of Senate seats. The model is based largely on polls and an online panel of voters. It also takes into account fundraising totals, voter demographics, and historical data. The researchers caution that Alaska is tricky to poll, and there have been few recent surveys. The Alaska data is from 452 internet respondents. Sullivan campaign spokesman Mike Anderson says YouGov's work is not based on the more reliable technique of random polling, but allows respondents to opt in or self-select. Anderson notes the Wall Street Journal reports Begich and Sullivan are evenly matched. The poll did not include numbers for Republican Joe Miller, who is also vying for the seat held by U.S. Senator Mark Begich. The specter of his 2010 run against Senator Lisa Murkowski looms large over his current campaign. Some of the residual effects strengthen Miller's candidacy, but the negatives are persistent. APRN's Liz Ruskin has this campaign profile.
Here's the story Joe Miller likes to tell about health care that he told at his campaign launch in April. When he was in first grade, he injured his lip in a bad fall.
And hit my face flat out on the floor. We didn't have health care, so of course I had to go to the doctor.
It healed badly. He lived with the disfigurement for 6 years, but he saved his money to pay for surgery.
I got a bus ticket. I went down to Wichita, Kansas, got an appointment, found a doctor, paid, I think at the time, $200 or $300, and cut the scar tissue off, and that was seventh grade.
It's a story of self-reliance and free enterprise, well-suited to a Tea Party candidate who rails against Obamacare, who says we must slash federal spending and entitlements to avoid national bankruptcy. There's another healthcare story he doesn't talk about. After Miller moved to Alaska and had kids of his own, his family signed up for Medicaid, the government health insurance program for the poor. Asked repeatedly how he feels about that period in his family's history, Miller turned the question into one of federal mandates.
I think it's an upside-down world when we think that the ruling class in Washington, D.C. should be making all these calls and decisions for us.
He says each state should decide whether to provide assistance. This is as close as he would come to discussing his own experience on Medicaid.
My family has been in situations where we have been in need. And as a consequence of it, our objective is not to leave other people in need. The objective is to make sure that we don't end up hitched up to a federal government that completely tubes the entire country.
The Medicaid episode is just one of a string of unflattering revelations from 2010. His campaign website lists some of them as myths. It minimizes the 2008 incident where he used his co-workers' computers at the Fairbanks North Star Borough to skew an online political poll. The campaign says he had a lapse in judgment. The time his bodyguards handcuffed a reporter? They weren't paid campaign staff, Miller's website explains, and anyway, one of them turned out to be an FBI informant working for the other side. As for the farm subsidies he accepted in the 90s, Miller says it was only about $100 a month. He says he's not sure he could refuse them since they were in place when he acquired the Kansas farmland.
I think that provides me with a better position probably than many other people to comment on why those programs are bad. You've got a government that basically is directing the farmer to grow a certain crop.
Miller beat Murkowski in the 2010 primary, only to lose to her in the general when she mounted a write-in campaign. He is clearly bitter toward Republicans who helped Murkowski win. He says he was done in by the Republican establishment and a multi-million-dollar smear campaign against him. Miller says his worst mistake of 2010 was letting establishment wing Republicans work on his campaign.
One of the biggest lessons was to keep the loyal folk around you and to recognize that when you're an anti-establishment reform candidate, you're going to have enemies from all sorts of unexpected places.
Miller points out he's the only non-millionaire in the race. He grew up in Kansas, the son of a church pastor, and he tells his supporters his family got by despite limited means.
My mom, for example, how many people remember Tough Skins from Sears? You know why you bought Tough Skins when you were a kid? Because you wore out the knee, Sears would give you a new pair.
He's a West Point grad and a veteran of the first Gulf War. He has a Yale law degree, and he's worked as a borough attorney and a magistrate. He also has a master's of economics from UAF. He and his wife, Kathleen, have 8 children and a grandchild. While 2010 left him with big negatives, he also emerged with a good chunk of campaign cash, more than $800,000. He transferred about half of it to the current campaign. Another benefit that grew from his 2010 race is a cadre of loyalists. His campaign launch in Wasilla was crowded with eager supporters. Christopher Kirka, executive director of Alaska Right to Life, was there with his family. Alaska Right to Life later endorsed Miller, even though his Republican opponents say they, too, oppose abortion. Kirka says his group is certain of Miller's commitment.
Joe's pro-life rhetoric is rooted in the core of who he is.
Anchorage political blogger Amanda Coyne says Miller appears more confident and fluent than he did in 2010. She ticks off his assets as a candidate.
Well, he has command of the issues, number one. He's got a clear vision, number two. He's incredibly articulate, number three. And his message appeals to the Tea Party base in the state, and the Tea Party base is very devoted and very committed to their candidates.
But Coyne says there's not much he can do to convince Alaskans to ignore what they learned about him 4 years ago.
To try to get over that 2010, those 2010 negatives would demand almost a personality transplant, and he's not going to do that, and he has no intention of doing that from what I've seen at least, and I don't think he can do that.
Polls suggest Miller is trailing Republicans Dan Sullivan and Mead Treadwell. If he loses on August 19, would he run as a third-party candidate? Miller won't say.
To do so, it'd be making basically a vicarious promise to both of my opponents that have already demonstrated a lack of trust in that area. They both, of course, supported Murkowski in 2010 against the Republican nominee.
As Miller sees it, Sullivan and Treadwell didn't respect his win in that primary, so they don't deserve his pledge to concede if he loses in this primary. For APRN, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Arctic nations come together in Russia for the Beringia Games.
When we start competing, it's just the same as competing at home. There's nothing different.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Several large earthquakes have hit southeast Alaska recently, but state seismologist Michael West with the Alaska Earthquake Information Center says it's unclear whether the activity is related.
We have no sort of direct lines of evidence that show that those earthquakes are related in any way. But as anybody feeling earthquakes day to day and keeping track of these things would note, there has truly been a clustering. There's been a little rash of earthquakes in southeast in recent months.
Friday's 5.9 magnitude earthquake about 97 miles west of Juneau was the latest to strike the region. Earlier this month, a 6.2 magnitude quake hit northwest of Yakutat, and in early June, a 5.7 quake struck near Glacier Bay National Park and Preserve. West says it's plausible to think the events are related to the largest earthquake in southeast in the last 2 years, a 7.5 magnitude tremor along the Queen Charlotte Fault in January of 2013. But he says proving it is not easy. West says seismologists are facing a challenge similar to doctors trying to determine why a certain type of cancer is more prevalent in a particular area.
People suspect that maybe it's the water supply or something like this. Well, it turns out to be a very, very hard thing to tell natural coincidence and clustering from something with a clear cause and effect.
He says Friday's tremor was a normal strike-slip quake where the earth moves horizontally along a vertical fault line. West says the only thing that made it somewhat unique was a 5.3 magnitude 4 shock about 45 seconds before the larger quake, but he says even that is fairly common. The image of Juneau's downtown ranges from the glamour of huge cruise ships and stores catering to tourists to street people with nowhere to go. An informal coalition has formed representing business and property owners, residents, and social service organizations to tackle some of the issues. KTOO's Rosemary Alexander has this first story in a series about problems in the capital city's downtown.
Bruce Denton has had an office in the Senate building on South Franklin Street for about 30 years. In May, he spent a lot of time outside painting, watching over downtown.
I had no idea how bad it had become.
Now he's a man with a mission. Denton asked filmmaker Pat Race to produce a short video of some of the things he'd seen from his perch.
My marching orders to Pat was that I didn't want it to be an indictment on any one group. I just basically wanted the bad and the ugly of what was going on downtown.
The video starts at Front and Franklin Street and pans the burned-down Gastineau apartments.
You look up Franklin Street and you go, why would I want to go there?
Pat Race calls it a snapshot of downtown.
I filmed everything from, like, puke and poop and people passed out on the doorsteps of businesses and broken windows and busted up sidewalks. I mean, it really ran the gamut. It's just a deterioration of attention.
It even picks up the north wall of Denton's Senate building.
It looks horrible. And I thought, oh, Pat, why could you do that to me? And I thought, well, wait a minute. This is what we're talking about. You know, we all need to take ownership.
Race deliberately shot the footage over a short period of time.
It's not cherry-picked. It's not all the greatest hits from the last month. It's everything that just happened within a few days. And it's pretty pervasive.
Pat Race also owns a business downtown. He says he wasn't surprised at the images he saw in his camera, but at how long he'd shut them out.
I think the thing that surprised me is how much I have my blinders on now. I think once you really start looking around, it's pretty appalling how many like cigarette butts are on the ground and how things haven't been painted in quite a while and just sort of what we let people get away with in a public space.
Just a lot of obnoxious activity, a lot of people operating below polite society.
Denton and Race have taken their concerns and the video to small groups of business and property owners, a few CBJ staff, and a couple of elected officials. The Downtown Neighborhood Association has even joined. Juneau Police Chief Bryce Johnson dubs the Coalition Dig for Downtown Improvement Group. Denton and Race recently met with Johnson and Police Lieutenant Dave Campbell, but they don't need a video to understand the issues. Campbell spent years on patrol.
Typically what we encounter in the downtown area is a lot of public nuisance type complaints. Lots of people are consuming alcohol.
And downtown Juneau consumes a lot of police presence, especially on weekends and evenings. When he steps out of his role as police lieutenant, Campbell admits downtown is sometimes an unpleasant place to be.
As a citizen, as a parent, I don't know, there's just an uncomfortable air about it.
Campbell says Denton is on the right track. He points to a study done years ago called Broken Windows.
If you have an area that's got broken windows and graffiti. It gives an unconscious message that nobody cares.
And such problems grow. The reverse, of course, is well-cared-for property, an inviting downtown.
You keep places clean. You know, you have the impression that somebody cares about it and that somebody's watching it. And as you're able to get ownership and get back, it actually has a positive effect towards these low-level quality of life issue crimes.
As Denton spreads his message, he says peer pressure is the way to start cleaning up downtown Juneau.
If your neighbor on both sides of your building cleans up their act, it kind of puts a lot of pressure on you to do the same thing.
While a general cleanup may be the best way to start, Denton and other members of the downtown group know it's only superficial. The tougher solutions may take years. Those conversations are just getting underway. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
Scores of rivers, creeks, and streams flow through Anchorage. People fish in them, play in them, and swim in them. But the city's seemingly pristine watershed has a dirty secret. It's largely contaminated with fecal bacteria. APRN's Joaquin Palomino has the story.
It's a beautiful day in Midtown, and Tom Ellie of the Anchorage Waterways Council circles the perimeter of a pond in Cuddy Park with his intern Robert V.
Okay, guy, do your duty.
All right.
Robert squats at the lake's edge and measures its temperature in Celsius.
22.4.
That's about 70 degrees Fahrenheit. He then unwraps an eyedropper, sucks up 5 milliliters of water, and drips it into a small vial so it can be tested for fecal coliform, a bacterium found in human and animal feces.
So if you find high fecal coliform counts, there's only one way that's getting in there, is that some sort of poop is going in the water.
Ellie has monitored the pond in Cuddy Park, which is actually a part of Fish Creek, for 13 years. He's found high levels of E. coli and other fecal bacteria in the waterway.
Don't fall in, you know. Don't get a mouthful of water. And we're not really sure where it's coming from.
Fecal pollution has many possible sources, such as leaking septic systems, homeless camps, and duck droppings. But Sherry Northen, executive director of the Anchorage Waterways Council, says the most common vector is probably dogs.
They figure there are about 65 to maybe 70,000 dogs in urban Anchorage. And if you do the math, it's several tons of pet waste a day. Tons. 20, 30 tons of pet waste a day, not a year, that ends up on the ground in Anchorage.
If dog owners don't pick it up, all of that poop gets washed into the city's streams and rivers. As of 2010, high levels of fecal bacteria landed essentially all of Anchorage's waterways on the EPA's impaired water list.
It's an invisible problem. It's not a floating piece of trash or an oil sheen or something like that. The water looks crystal clear, and yet it's carrying all this bacteria.
Fecal bacteria isn't uncommon in urban waterways, and it doesn't harm fish or other wildlife. It can cause nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea, though, if ingested by humans, which is why Northen says Anchorage's watershed needs to be cleaned up.
We've gone down Campbell Creek. My husband fell off the back of our raft once. And, you know, if in that situation, you grab a mouthful of water. I've fallen into Little Campbell Creek. You're not planning on it, but you still get it in your mouth.
Tim Stevens with the Department of Environmental Conservation says state and local agencies are trying to remove fecal bacteria from Anchorage's watershed in a number of ways, including
doing educational campaigns to educate pet owners to pick up after their pets. The city has standard ordinances dealing with septic systems, and they are doing street sweeping to reduce the amount of bacteria getting into the streams through stormwater.
Over the past few years, three Anchorage lakes have been removed from the impaired water list, including Lake Hood and Lake Spinard. In Anchorage, I'm Joaquin Palomino.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. And by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine.
The owners of Clearwater Lodge near Delta Junction have decided to rebuild the historic structure that burned down in May. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, fans and friends of the lodge want to help get work started with a fundraiser next month.
Kevin Ewing says he and his wife Patsy have decided to build a new lodge on the site of the old one at a scenic bend in the Clearwater River. It's a place familiar to fishermen, snow machine racers, and countless others from all over who've congregated there over the past 60 years.
We love the place, love the setting. You know, it deserves to have something there that other people can enjoy.
Ewing says he's signed on a local architect to design a structure that will resemble the old Clearwater, including a wall featuring photos of the many events that have been held at the lodge over the decades.
Kind of want to keep it similar so that there's similar materials used in it. It's not going to be built anything like it was, obviously. It was old creosote building with 2x4 walls and stuff.
The new lodge will not have the smell of musty old creosote-treated timbers like the old structure. In fact, it'll feature smoke-free dining and more windows that'll allow diners more views, both indoors and outdoors on the expanded deck.
The whole front now will all be views, so the deck will probably end up being larger than it was. A nice big outdoor deck, and partially covered, too.
Ewing says he and Patsy hope to start work on the new lodge next spring and get enough work done to have a grand opening on July 4th. He says they haven't had enough time to work on it this summer, not only because of his day job at Pump Station 9, but also due to time-consuming work on insurance issues and other matters related to the May 15th fire. Meanwhile, friends and supporters are planning a fundraiser to help support the reconstruction effort. Jay Miller is a Fort Greely firefighter, and he says the Post's Firefighter Association is sponsoring the August 15th event to be held at the site of the old lodge. Miller says it'll be called the Clearwater Revival Music Festival. He says the organization hopes it'll be the first of many.
We're going to try to make this a yearly event, a music festival behind the Clearwater.
You can find out more about the event by going online and checking the Music Fest's Facebook page. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
This time of year, Indigenous people across the far north gather to play games and celebrate traditions. Earlier this month in Fairbanks, they took part in the World Eskimo Indian Olympics. There was also a gathering of people from across the circumpolar north in Inuvik, Canada. This year, Native people from Arctic nations joined Russia's Chukchi and Inuit people for the first ever Beringia Arctic Games. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, it was the largest gathering of its kind in a once-forgotten corner of the world called Chukotka.
Seven women row a long, wide boat out to the middle of a protected bay off Russia's Bering Sea coast. A flare soars into the air, and they pull with all their strength at long wooden oars. They're in a race against seven other teams in seven other boats. These are skin boats made from hand-carved driftwood and the hides of two female walrus. Valentina Eitan stands at the back of one. She mans a giant wooden rudder and counts strokes in Russian to help her team keep their cadence. By the end of the race, her voice is hoarse. Of course, we're very happy to win the race, says Eitan. But we had a lot of training. She says her team is very thankful for the men in her village and her uncle, who helped build their boat. This year, more than 20 athletes from seven Arctic nations, including Canada, Norway, the United States, Iceland, Greenland, and the Faroe Islands, joined the competition in Russia. They also took part in other games of agility, endurance, and strength that test traditional hunting and survival skills. In a school gymnasium, competition is fierce during the one-arm reach. In this game, an athlete balances their entire body on one hand and reaches above their head for a tennis ball, but their legs can't touch the floor. It's the same movement you might make if you were gathering bird eggs from a rocky cliff. Johnny Isaluk is from Iqaluit on Canada's Baffin Island. He was surprised to discover Russia's Chukchi people play the same games as Canada's Inuit.
When we start competing, just the same as competing at home. And, you know, like, there's nothing different.
Isaluk says the Russian competition is stiff because they're here to represent their villages. Andrei Kainanen agrees. He's one of 200 residents who lives here in the coastal village of Novochaplina. Kainanen captains a skin boat for his village. He says the event is good because it brings people together. He says the people in Novochaplina took the time to make their village presentable for their guests. The games were met with traditional drumming and dancing. Olga Letikai is from Enmelium, a small coastal village to the south. She came to sing. She also works as a liaison between the Russian government and local marine mammal hunters. As more attention is paid to natural resources in the region, she says there's dialogue on all sides.
Of course, the society of Chukotka, it's changing. Like all the world, it's changed. And I think the most important thing is to take a balance between tradition and modern life.
The challenge to find that balance is familiar for Sam Nystad, a native Sami from Norway's Finnmark region.
The Western world has definitely like taken a big chunk in the Sami culture. And, well, the thing is that I was actually kind of impressed by how they preserved their culture, but also how they kind of want to show it to the world through the games.
After 2 days, the official games come to a close, but the residents of Novochaplina aren't ready to quit. A group of teenage girls from Greenland sings around a bonfire as Andrei Kainanen shows the crowd a new game. Men carry a giant rock around in a circle until their arms are exhausted. As a midnight sun sinks below the horizon, other local games last well into the night, the same way they have for generations. I'm Emily Schwing in Novochaplina, Chukotka.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly and Rosemary Alexander in Juneau, Joaquin Palomino in Anchorage, Tim Ellis in Delta, and Emily Schwing in Russia. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at crowleyalaska.com. Attention, Alaska gardeners. Invasive weeds are a threat to landscaping, lawns, and gardens. They can spread and harm Alaska wildlife and waterways. Potted plants, hay, gravel, and soil, even clothing and vehicles can transport invasive plants to Alaska. So learn more at alaskainvasives.org. Let's protect Alaska together. Visit alaskainvasives.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Agriculture and the U.S. Forest Service. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.